Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Richard Wolff, who is the author of a book, Renegade, a book that's just come out, basically come out in the last couple of days, Renegade, The Making of the President. And we'll be talking to him. He is an award-winning journalist and political analyst for MSNBC television. He appears frequently on MSNBC's Countdown with Keith Olbermann and Hardball with Chris Matthews. He covered the entire length of the Barack Obama's presidential campaign for Newsweek magazine. And before Newsweek, Richard Wolff was a senior journalist with the Financial Times, serving as its deputy bureau chief and U.S. diplomatic correspondent. And who will give us a true insider's account of not just the election of Barack Obama, but who this new president is. And he's continued to stay in touch with him and get a sense of how he's dealing with the extraordinary challenges ahead. And then we'll look into another big story in the news, which is to some extent a reflection of what just happened the other day in Kansas City with the murdering of an abortion doctor, indicating that the religious wars are still going on, culture wars and religious wars are still going on in this country to a deadly degree. We'll be talking to an evangelist who had a change of heart. Frank Schaefer will be joining us. He's the author of a book, Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. He's going to be talking to us and demystifying the rise of the religious right, which, of course, he was intimately involved with, giving us an insider's perspective of this powerful movement, which has largely captured the Republican Party. And it's also a personal memoir of his comings of age as an evangelist and eventually leading to a crisis of faith and a change of heart. Let's now begin with Richard Wolff. The only time I could get Richard, because he's very much in demand, he's on all the television talk shows today, was a little while ago I recorded him. Unfortunately, you will hear the ticking clock, which is yet another minefield here in terms of trying to get radio that you can hear. Let's now go to the interview with the caveats that after a while the ticking clock will go away. I'm speaking with Richard Wolff, who's an award-winning journalist and political analyst for MSNBC television. He covered the entire length of Barack Obama's presidential campaign for Newsweek magazine, traveling with a candidate, and he's in a circle from his announcement through Election Day 21 months later. And he's the author of a new book we're offering up here as a premium here in today's fund drive. It's called Renegade, The Making of the President. And Richard Wolff, the extraordinary thing that first struck me is that the candidate himself actually suggested you write this book, and it seemed like he'd thought it through more than you had.
He did, because I told him it was a stupid idea. He suggested that, you know, it would be great to sort of be an observer on his own campaign, which was itself kind of a strange thing. And then he said, you know, why don't you write a book about it? We were chatting on his plane one day. I did say that I thought that the genre of campaign books was dead. And he told me how much he loved the Teddy White books, which were great, but they were also a long time ago. And obviously, I went away and reconsidered my hasty judgment. And look, he gave me the idea, but the inspiration for the book, the real reason for writing the book, was not so much because he had an idea about it, but because the story was so compelling that I thought it had to be told by someone who was actually there.
And in terms of his ability to think ahead and be a strategic thinker, which has been sorely lacking in, particularly in our foreign policy, I think arguably Clinton was a tactical thinker.
Right.
You know, obviously he wasn't thinking when during the Monica Lewinsky thing, but by and large, he was tactical. This guy seems to be very strategic. In fact, what seems to be happening now in this with this trip to Europe and the speech in Cairo seems to be in many ways aimed at trying to influence the elections in Iran, which is would remove a major blockage to his ambitions to try and fix that region.
Well, you're absolutely right. He does think ahead. He thought ahead not just with this book, but with that speech you're talking about, the Muslim speech he'd been planning for at least 2 years. And he does this, have this ability to seek out weaknesses in his adversaries to try and plot ahead and think ahead. And there is a difference, even with Clinton, in terms of his foreign policy. Well, obviously, one of the criticisms of Clinton's foreign policy, President Clinton's foreign policy, was a sort of haphazard nature to it. Here, in contrast, is someone who got to know Pakistan very well as a student, actually, at Occidental, and had Pakistani friends, has thought a lot about Sunni-Shia differences, about Pakistan and Afghanistan, and more broadly about Muslim opinion and how to influence it in a way that hasn't really been a feature of American foreign policy for many years.
Yes, in fact, he was on with Brian Williams the other day, and he answered the question which many of his critics and the punditry have been posing, which is that he's taken on too much, there's just too much on his plate. And he sort of said rhetorically, well, what am I supposed to do, forget about Pakistan?
Right, and that's true. I mean, you know, I'm convinced that all of them would like to be doing less work, up to and including the president. He seemed actually quite tired when I interviewed him in the Oval Office. Any one of these challenges would be enormous, but you can't leave one of the two wars out. You can't ignore the economic collapse. And, well, I guess he doesn't have to do health care right now, but then that's part of the economy too.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Wolff, who's the award-winning journalist and political analyst at MSNBC Television, appearing frequently on MSNBC's Countdown with Keith Olbermann and Hardball with Chris Matthews. He's the author of a new book we're offering up here for, as a premium in our fund drive at 818-985-5735, the book Renegade, The Making of the President. And just going back to sort of chronologically go through the campaign a little with you, Richard Wolff, the first big wrinkle, well, first of all, convincing him to run, he was a reluctant candidate. I was very struck by the anecdote you tell in the book about he's on vacation in Hawaii, mm-hmm. and perfect strangers walk up to him and said, you got to run.
That's right. And he was taken aback, actually. Look, he's an ambitious, reluctant candidate, and there's no question that this was something he wanted to do at some point, but there were serious doubts to the point where, really, the people who ended up running his campaign thought that he wasn't going to do it, right up until the last minute. And one of the things that they thought was leading him to not running was precisely that reaction of the guy who stops in Hawaii. He was getting this realization that a normal life just wasn't going to be possible. And I've got to tell you, even through the first year, through the primaries, through the general election, he really had trouble dealing with the loss of privacy and normal family life that was part and parcel of running for president. And that was certainly one major reason to hesitate before and to be doubtful about whether to run. And it was a source of great discomfort and really some pain as the campaign began and continued.
And in your recent talk with him in the Oval Office, how's he adjusting in terms of his family life?
Well, look, I think this is the most time he's ever spent with his family, to be honest, in the sense that when he was a state senator, he was working out of Springfield, Illinois, and his family were in Chicago. As a U.S. senator, he was in Washington, and his family were in Chicago. Then he was campaigning across the country for 2 years. You know, one of the questions Michelle Obama asked the political folks before they ran was, is he going to get weekends off? And the answer was absolutely not. So here he is in a situation where at least he can spend his weekends with his family. They're all living in the same place. They're in the same town for once, really for the first time since his kids were born. On the other hand, the work is obviously overwhelming. I mean, if this guy has any restlessness left in him, it's more than taken up with the scale of the challenges he has to deal with.
Well, I guess it's his staff that their family life is suffering.
That would be true.
So, Richard Wolff, the first big bump in on the road to the presidency obviously was the Reverend Wright. I had no idea, and you reveal in your book that, in fact, it was bad staff work. He had asked them to look at all of those videotapes of Wright's sermons.
That's right. The dirty secret about Reverend Wright is that Obama wasn't really in church very often. You know, people on the right keep saying, well, he must have been sitting through this, he must have been hearing it, how could it have been otherwise? Truth was, as he explained to me, he had young kids. When his kids were young, he didn't really go to church a whole lot. Then he was campaigning for one office or another. And when he went to church, he was to some other church to campaign for votes, not to listen to Reverend Wright give a sermon. That was kind of difficult to explain in the middle of the campaign, but when the story first emerged, right at the start of the campaign, at really the time he launched, there was a story in Rolling Stone about some inflammatory rhetoric coming from Reverend Wright, and the candidate said to his staff at that point, go look at all these sermons, and that work was never done. It slipped through the cracks. It was a major, major mistake. And they were just very, very fortunate that the sermons only emerged in the media well after he'd won many, many primaries.
And he met secretly with the Reverend Wright to discourage him from his media tour, which turned out to be a meltdown for the man. He clearly was not ready for prime time.
That's right. He tried to convince Wright that in the age of blogs and cable TV, that in his own words, he was headed for vilification, not vindication. And they had this conversation at Wright's home in Chicago. It obviously didn't go well. Wright felt that he was the aggrieved party and was determined to continue, and he was indeed vilified. And I have to say, though, Wright's comeback tour, if you can call it that, really almost sank the campaign. They saw their numbers decline precipitously just before the Indiana and North Carolina primaries, really the last big primaries of the whole thing. And they really feared the worst. As it turned out, they just about they only just lost in Indiana, and they won very heavily in North Carolina, and that was the end of it. But it could have worked out very differently.
Well, obviously the reason, Richard Wolff, is that it was seized upon, particularly by Fox. I mean, you know, here's this idea that that there's a liberal media, this constant canard. But if you think back, he was portrayed as an agent of this intolerant sort of reverse racist, and he was in favor of child molesters, and he hung out with terrorists.
Right, and to be fair, though, I mean, apart those latter two were very much pushed by Fox, but everyone on TV indulged in playing the Reverend Wright tapes over and over and over again, and it was some of the worst media coverage I've ever seen of any presidential candidate. And remember, by the way, this is in a period, the whole Wright comeback and his original appearance was in the period when he was losing in Pennsylvania, and he lost Pennsylvania. He had lost in Texas and Ohio. He made these comments about the bitterness of small-town America. And I find it a curious thing that people say now, well, the media coverage has been so enamored and biased with Obama and for Obama. Well, you can only say that if you selectively erase the period of Reverend Wright, which was 2 months, as I say, of the worst coverage any candidate has seen, I guess since Howard Dean screamed, at least. But, you know, there was plenty of negative coverage of this candidate, and people are choosing to forget about that.
Well, but I think in this age of cable TV, it's particularly when it's so partisan, you get the impression that they will seize on anything. It's almost like they're venues for opposition research. I mean, the speech that you just mentioned, the one that was in Marin County that blew up in his face in Pennsylvania about people resorting to religion and guns. Essentially, if you read that in context, it's not particularly inflammatory, and nor is what Sonia Sotomayor said in her speeches as well that have been seized upon. I mean, isn't this a reflection of this this age of 24-hour cable seizing on stuff that ends up sort of being an extension of opposition research?
I can't really speak to why cable TV producers do what they do. Obviously, there's a search for ratings and sensationalism to some degree. But I do think that what we saw in that last election was one campaign effectively trying to manage the cable news cycle. And the McCain campaign could do that and did do that from an hour-to-hour basis. But in the end, it was really limited. It didn't actually answer the big questions. So they had lots of coverage about lipstick on a pig, and cable TV loved it. But you know something? It didn't win them votes. And there's a real limitation to that kind of strategy. You're speaking to political insiders. You're speaking to your own base. Let's face it, there aren't really crossover voters here. This is a pretty solid Democrats watching one thing and solid Republicans watching another. And the Obama campaign figured out that they needed to kind of go beyond that and speak to the bigger problems and very real problems that voters were facing.
Well, I think the game changer surely was the economic collapse, and I don't think you have to be a cynic to suggest that Bush, Cheney and company were hoping they could squeak by without the whole thing falling apart, which it did in the last couple of months. And in your book, Renegade Richard Wolf, you describe when Obama went to Washington, to the White House, and McCain was there. Remember, he suspended his campaign. And the absolute shock at the disarray in the White House. Was that a window into how it really was all along? I mean, in many ways, in spite of all the ideology, the main critique of the Bush-Cheney era is one of unbridled incompetence and the reckless endangerment of the United States.
The economic meltdown was a key point. There's no question about it. I hear a lot of people on the right, people who like John McCain, say everything was a result of that. I actually think it was the result of the way they responded to the crisis. It was a real-time test, and McCain reacted in an erratic and frankly kind of irrational way. So voters responded with some concerns about that, whereas Obama was much more cautious and stable and considered. You know, the foreign policy piece of it is, the context of those kinds of judgments, I think, was obviously what happened in the Bush years, because while, you know, at the time, people may have felt reassured by President Bush's reaction to 9/11, obviously what followed was deeply traumatic for America and for the rest of the world, especially, obviously, the invasion of Iraq. And so it's not unreasonable to want to look closely and pay close attention to how these candidates, any candidates, respond under pressure and to a real crisis. And those are important judgments. I mean, it's an obvious point to say that presidents have a huge amount of power, but their decision-making under stress is an important guide to how they're going to exercise power.
Well, I think there is such a profound difference between the styles of the two, outgoing president and his successor. I mean Bush, we'll leave aside questions of competence, but he did indeed, he came across as somebody that was trying to assert authority. I'm the decider. He wasn't sharing anything with anybody. He was just dictating. Whereas this guy seems to be very confident in his own skin. He wants to share the journey he's taking with the American people and wants to treat them as adults.
I think he does, and I think people react positively to the sort of thinking out loud quality that Obama has, in the sense that he's taking them on a journey and explaining situations that are complex. They are actually complex. We've been lulled into some sort of comfort by thinking that there are simple principles or even a coherent, monolithic Muslim world. I hear this all the time, that this was a speech to the Muslim world. But one thing that Obama understands, because as I explain in the book, because of his childhood, because of his friendships in college, because of his family background, is that Muslim life is incredibly varied between Indonesia, where you have an incredible mix of religions and faiths, through, obviously, the Middle East, which is what everyone thinks about, to North Africa and the Horn of Africa. There's a range and diversity, and of course the Indian subcontinent, there's a range and diversity of Muslim thought that actually offers opportunities to America. I mean, it's not just about understanding the difference between Sunni and Shia, because if you can break apart the idea that all Muslims think alike, or all of them support radical jihadists and oppose or hate America, then you have an opening. That's how, actually, America successfully waged the Cold War, which was to find people in Europe, even people on the left in Europe, who didn't agree with communist and Soviet power. That's smart politics and diplomacy.
Well, presumably that was the intention of the speech in Cairo, which is to the only people who can dissuade an Islamist from becoming a radical are moderate Islamists. And so far, we have, in terms of foreign policy, we've isolated and undercut them. And he clearly is trying to engage, but that's not to say he's not going to have a minefield ahead of him. It's quite a challenge to try and fix that one and healthcare at the same time.
The challenges are honestly astonishing. I'm surprised any of them are getting any sleep.
And tell me about the incident that you reveal in your book again, Richard Wolff, Renegade, The Making of a President. Renegade, of course, is the Secret Service code name for Barack Obama. And you mentioned in the book also, Richard Wolff, that Sasha Obama refers to the Secret Service as the secret people.
That's right.
And but he's the first president, at least in memory, that actually invited the Secret Service to join them for a family dinner at Thanksgiving. Let me just touch on Michelle Obama. She's obviously a prominent person, and you mentioned some of the snarking that came from Maureen Dowd about her putting her husband down. But it did. She did apparently assert herself after the losses in Texas and Ohio. She really got angry at their failed strategy and threatened not to return to the campaign trail. So, give us a sense of what happened when she started to, weigh in.
Michelle Obama was not a fan of campaigns in general. She had not been engaged in his campaigns before. She thought that there was something sort of cheap and trivial about politics in general, not policy and public service. She's deeply committed to that. But she was very a big player when it came to deciding whether or not to run. And she threw herself in. She's a very competitive woman. But there was one moment when she really had enough, and that was when they lost in Texas and Ohio. The next morning, she had a conversation, I think in diplomatic circles they call it a frank exchange of views, with her husband and his campaign manager, David Plouffe. And she said, if you don't come up with a better strategy, I'm not going out and campaigning anymore. And the rest of the car journey to the airport was apparently very frosty. She was an important player. She was a phenomenal performer. Obviously, there were times when either she misspoke or there was hostile coverage, because I think it was easier to criticize her than it was her husband. But she, in the end, has proved invaluable and is proving invaluable. I mean, the fact that her numbers right now, her approval numbers, are higher than Laura Bush's, I think would have been hard to predict for anyone who watched this campaign and watched the kind of harsh treatment she was given.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Wolff, who's an award-winning journalist and political analyst for MSNBC Television, appearing frequently on MSNBC's Countdown with Keith Olbermann and Hardball with Chris Matthews. He's the author of Renegade, The Making of the President. And Richard Wolff covered the entire campaign for Newsweek as an insider, and starting with the announcement in Springfield on that bitterly cold day, all the way to the rally in Grant Park when President Obama was elected. And of course I recall looking at that, and actually everybody that I was looking at it with, they were in tears, including Jesse Jackson, who was openly weeping. It was an extraordinary moment, and you were right there. That's quite an enviable position to be in.
Oh, listen, it was an extraordinary front row seat that I had this whole time, and that's what I really wanted to share with readers. I thought that this is the story that really needed to be told by someone who was there. And I wanted to give people an impression of what it was like to be there, as well as answering this really, I think, critical question about who he is.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Wolff, the author of Renegade, The Making of the President, which we're offering up as a premium here at 818-985-5735. And just to get to the present, again, Richard Wolff. The AP's feeding in. When you met with the president recently in the Oval Office, you said he was lamenting how hard it is to get anything done, how slow it is to turn around the government and the right. country as though it's some sort of giant super tanker trying to maneuver. What's the inside sort of answer to his strategy then? Because, as I say, he's been criticized for taking on too much, but how can you ignore all of these incredibly important issues that are facing him, these monumental challenges? What's your sense of how he's going to navigate, in particularly with the opposition? Because if my take from your book and from reflecting back on the election was that there's a sort of element in this country that simply you can't try and win them over. You know, there's no point in being nice to people who are sort of congenitally mean. And, you know, Fox's response recently to the speech, Obama's speech in Cairo, I think is exemplifies this. They were saying, oh, he's thrown the intel community under the bus. You know, some sort of pretty woman saying that. Makes no sense, but they will say stuff and do stuff. And so far, the opposition in this country has had no kind of plan. But at what point does he sort of stop trying to engage them and just use the weight of his presidency and presumably, if Al Franken gets seated, the 60 threshold filibuster threshold? In other words, is this guy going to come out fighting at one point?
I think that he is not really playing to that crowd in the sense that he thinks Republicans or viewers of Fox News are going to come to his side. He's really trying to speak to independent voters, disillusioned Republicans, which have been a really growing voting bloc in this country because the Republican Party has become toxic over the last several years. And those independent voters are the ones who really put him over the top. In Virginia, in Indiana, in North Carolina, they have been key to his success, even going back to Iowa. So to appear reasonable, to take on board criticism, to adjust positions, and show that you're willing to work with the other party, even if the other party doesn't want to do so, is still helpful with those independent voters. Does that mean he's going to come out fighting? Well, that was the key question through the campaign, and he showed he had the stomach for the fight because he took it to Hillary Clinton and was actually pretty blunt about many things, about truth-telling, about character, about her husband. As he used to say, he may be skinny, but he's tough.
Well, you've experienced that on the basketball court with him, haven't you?
I have. And when he cannot keep up with you, which being old man basketball, and I include myself in that description, he is more than ready to shout out abuse. So it's a very different side of the man who is now the president.
Well, I just spoke a week or so ago with Lawrence Wilkerson, the former chief of staff of the State Department, Colin Powell's right-hand yep. man, who was the first to sort of split with the administration in the sense that he referred to the cabal, the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal. Clearly, no love lost there. But he said that in response to what Dick Cheney's saying, just to put it in context, there's never been quite a high-level challenge to a sitting president's national security credentials since General MacArthur challenged President Truman. And he went on to say that maybe Cheney and Limbaugh and these people who have an investment in Obama's failure don't have such a crazy strategy because there could be another attack in the next four and certainly in the next eight, more likely. And the economy could turn sour even more so than it has. And Wilkerson's characterization of the opposition, or this particular opposition, was that they're almost treasonous. So again, I suppose I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but at what point does this get clearer that this is kind of the subtext of what's happening here? You may not agree with it, but it's, there's certainly some that think that's what that, this is the case.
Well, just to pick up on the economy situation, I mean, if the economy, never mind if it gets worse, if it doesn't get better in time for next year's elections, then this presidency becomes so much harder. I mean, then you're looking at a repeat of what happened to President Clinton. You know, the economic fortunes of this country and how voters understand that are really going to decide the next election and whether this president has the authority to do very much beyond the next year or two. So, you know, to the extent that he controls that, I guess he has to work as hard as possible on that. But, of course, economic growth and decline is also in large measure outside of the control of a president. So we have to see how the timing plays out here, because that is really going to affect his claim to greatness and what he does through his first term.
So at this point, just in closing, Richard Wolff, the honeymoon seems to be on,
yes,
which is, I think, in itself a remarkable situation, given how many people are unemployed and how much distress there is out there in the land. But the long and the short of it is that we haven't, I mean, this is my opinion, we haven't had this kind of talent in this job for some time, at least in my memory. And do you think that that's a widely shared view? I mean, I think reading between the lines, you're pretty impressed with this guy too, right?
Well, I think he has a tremendous capacity to learn. I think he is an agile thinker, and he works hard at improving himself and his knowledge. And those are all qualities I think voters found very reassuring as they went to the polls. It's hard to dislike him, but I'll admit that I thought the same about a certain Texas governor in 2000, and I covered his campaign. I think it's incumbent on journalists covering campaigns to look beyond the personal charisma of these people and really test their policies. Test whether they understand their own policies, whether they go beyond the talking points, whether the policies jibe with the real world in some way or with what other policy experts are saying. And, you know, that's what I was trying to do through this book process and through covering his campaign. I tried to push him and probe him and analyze and test and explain and report. And I would like to think that's what all political journalists should do.
Well, indeed, you refer to him, although he's a renegade, he was also cautious and a pragmatic one. He played by the rules when he needed them to win. On the surface, his performance was steady, as a heartbeat rate. And yet, he had private moods. He was cocky, grumpy, impatient. Mm-hmm. I guess at the end of the day, you're giving more information about this man than anybody else, and it's extraordinarily valuable. But I get the impression that just in closing, that there's still a bit of an enigma there, right?
I think there is. I think there's something intentionally hidden about him. And if I manage to get 80% of the way to the real person, then I'd be happy. But he for all the happiness and comfort in being in front of a big crowd, is still something of a loner. And, you know, there's something very complex there that needed to be, I thought, explored in this book, explored by someone, like I said, who was there, not from a distance. And he certainly proved a fascinating person to follow and to write about.
I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Richard Wolff.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Richard Wolff, who's an award-winning journalist and political analyst for MSNBC television, appearing frequently on MSNBC's Countdown with Keith Olbermann and Hardball with Chris Matthews. He covered the entire length of Barack Obama's presidential campaign for Newsweek magazine. And before Newsweek, Richard Wolff was a senior journalist at the Financial Times, serving as its deputy bureau chief and U.S. diplomatic correspondent. And Frank Schaeffer's fiction and nonfiction rises. His books, Keeping the Faith, A Father and Son Story About Love, and the U.S. Marine Corps. It was a New York Times bestseller. and his Calvin Becker trilogy of novels also explores the dilemmas of members of the Christian fundamentalist community. He's written for USA Today, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Los Angeles Times, and is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post website and blog. He has appeared on many television shows, and Oprah, Fox News, CNN, ABC 2020, and on NPR's All Things Considered on the PBS NewsHour. The book is Crazy for God, and How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. Welcome to the program, Frank Schaefer.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And clearly this has been a... yesterday there was a funeral in Wichita, Kansas, for Dr. Tiller. And I was mentioning earlier, we were talking about... Fox News, particularly Bill O'Reilly, who for a number of years has been referring to Dr. Tiller as Tiller the baby killer, and in general equating this man with what has to be in our lexicon of outrage. There's nothing worse than the concept of somebody that would kill a child. I suppose child molester might be slightly worse, but not really. And yet, there's this reaction from people like O'Reilly and the people that are protesting. You know, it's how dare you even suggest we had anything to do with this?
Yeah, well, you know, I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post after Dr. Tiller's murder in which I tracked back along some of the rhetoric that people like me back in the 70s and 80s were using when I was very involved in the religious right, which I talk about in the book. And really, there's a direct line from that incendiary language that people like me used and that the religious right and folks on Fox are still using today unrepentantly to acts of violence. And of course, just to cut to the chase here, if you followed the logic of what they have been saying about President Obama, both during the race and then also since he's been elected, that he's not a real American, secret Muslim, making America less safe, turning America into a communist country, all this nonsense.
Hanging out with terrorists.
Yeah, hanging out with terrorists, speaking for bin Laden, doing bin Laden's work for him, to quote Rush Limbaugh most recently just last week. You know, the logical line there for some unhinged person standing on the sideline is to grab a gun and take a shot at the president. And they know this, we know this, and the game that the religious right and the right wing in America is playing today with the kind of words they use is not only incendiary, but it is really something that is so irresponsible that it boggles the mind. It actually has to be happening in order to believe it, but it is happening. And this piece I wrote for the Huffington Post, which ties into my book Crazy for God, was a kind of a mea culpa in saying, look, I want to be honest here. This doctor was murdered. As I look back on the kind of things I used to say and how I said them, I was part of the rise of a right-wing religious movement with violent overtones that basically uses the kind of terminology which is like a fishing expedition for those people who were slightly unhinged, standing on the sidelines, well-armed, in a country awash with guns. And it's really like playing Russian roulette. Sooner or later, you get one in the chamber that's loaded, and the gun goes off. And it'll happen again. It's happened before. It's not just about abortion. It's about other parts of our civic culture, including politics, where we've had assassinations before, as we all know too well in our bitter history. And so, you know, the piece I wrote, and I guess the conclusion of the book Crazy for God, is that it's not a question of trying to stifle dissent. It's a question of trying to make that dissent both responsible and at least adhere to some version of the truth. The thing that just strikes me almost dumb when I look at what Fox News says, for instance, or Rush Limbaugh or Ann Coulter or these people on a daily basis, is that what they talk about when it comes to President Obama or the issue of abortion, but let's just look at the president for a moment, say his recent Mideast speech delivered in Cairo, has no relationship to the actual fact even of what he said or believes. In other words, in addition to being extreme in the language of vilification, you have a level of absolute barefaced lying that, at least in my lifetime, I'm 57 years old, okay, so for the last 40 years maybe aware politically, is unprecedented. I've never seen such a tissue of whole cloth lies. And, you know, as I talk about in the book, my father, Francis Schaeffer, was a well-known evangelist. We were working with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who became Reagan's Surgeon General. We founded the Evangelical Pro-Life Movement. The people that we talked into joining us were folks whose names are well-known, like Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, Dr. Dobson, Focus on the Family, and these others. And, you know, from the beginning, there was a radical twist to what we were doing, but it's gone from there. In other words, even looking at it in the light of the 70s and 80s, things are now so much further down the road towards just barefaced lying, combined with a viciousness which really is amazing and reminds me of the sort of stuff that was being said in the beer halls of Germany in the 1930s trying to stir up a fascist revolution there, that I really think it's time, no matter what our political views are, or whether we're Republicans, Democrats, moderates, whatever you might be, to stand up and just say enough is enough. So what I've been trying to do in these posts I'm writing and in the book, Crazy for God, is not try to turn everybody into a progressive Democrat, but just say, look, there are bounds of decency that have been crossed here. No matter what your view of America is, we don't want this country to be reduced to chaos through assassination and intimidation. These folks are bad news, no matter what your politics is, and that's been the point of what I've been trying to do.
So, Frank Schaeffer, where along the way did the evangelical movement, which is obviously an intrinsic part of Christianity,
right?
How did it become a front for right-wing politics, and now, as you just pointed out, has evolved into a front for the most rabid right-wing politics?
Yeah, and I'll go even further than that, a rabid right-wing that hates the United States, wraps itself in the flag, but hates this country. And when I say that, I'm not exaggerating. They hate America as it is. They hate this country as a pluralistic, multicultural democracy, and you see it coming out in the gay bashing, you see it in the incipient racism, you see it in all these issues, but these folks want to overthrow the order as we know it. They do not like America. They are as anti-American as Bin Laden and those other people, and that's where it has come to. And the way it started, just to look at my own biography, when I was a young man back in the 70s, we got into the issue of abortion after Roe v. Wade, which, by the way, in my book, I think was a decision that was badly made in that it was sweeping and put everybody on edge and would have been better to argue state by state, but that's just a matter of tactics. But the fact of the matter is we got into that issue genuinely out of a Christian compassion for mothers, children, the unborn, life, and whether we were right or wrong, the intent was not political. But very quickly that movement, and I don't know who seduced whom, but very quickly that movement, and in my case, for instance, just speaking personally, after I used to meet on a regular basis with Congressman Jack Kemp, who then became Bob Dole's vice presidential candidate, after our family got to know both the Fords and the Bush family very well personally, my dad met with Ronald Reagan and so forth, you know, gradually what happened is we were seduced by the Republican Party, who told us, look, you find a home here. We will be the party of Christian conscience. We will be the party of evangelical Christians. And as I point out in the book, at least from my point of view as a young man, this was very heady stuff. It was also very lucrative. Just to cut to the chase here, after I walked away from the evangelical right wing in the mid-80s, and completely disengaged in 1990, in the sense that I began to write against it, not just get out, but write against it, my income dropped by about 70%, and it's never come back because the big bucks were in the God business combined with right-wing politics. If you wanted to be venal about it, where you would sell a lot of books was with people like, for instance, Regnery Gateway and the Conservative Book Club, which is where Ann Coulter's made all her money. You know, the books I was writing then, I was selling literally thousands for every one copy I would sell now to what you might call the ordinary American, non-politicized, non-right-wing public. So for me, it was a combination of greed, power. It's very nice to have people sending limos to meet you at the airport. Jerry Falwell would send his jet whenever I'd go speak for him, sometimes lend it to me to go speak to unrelated events. It's nice to have the personal number that rings by the bedside of Jack Kemp and Bob Dole. have Barbara Bush come to lunch. All this is cool stuff. One morning you wake up and you realize this is no longer about my religion. It's no longer about faith. It's no longer about America. It's about power. And we're being used or using others, whichever, you know, cart and horse situation comes first. But this is so far from anything I ever signed on to do. And the people we're in bed with are so rabidly hostile to anybody who disagrees with them, say, starting with gay people, that, you know, I realized at about age 30 that, you know, another step down this path and this would be who I was for the rest of my life. And I just couldn't take it. And it wasn't so much an act of principle as just one of revulsion. And I think it all comes to the point that I talk about in the book when I say, look, you know, we were the anti-American party. We basically, bad news was good news to us. Sexual promiscuity and STDs and teen pregnancy, that was all great because it proved we were right. Everybody needed Jesus. They needed Republicans. We needed prayer in schools, get rid of sex education, no more contraceptive distribution in high schools. Crime rate, same thing, goes to show we're a decadent country. And where you saw the awful logic of that played to its final conclusion was after 9/11, when Falwell and Robertson stood up, and this was long after I was out of the business of the God business, and said we had it coming. We were punished for having gay people in our country, and of course they had to take it back, but they never took it back privately. So really what happened is you had people within these big ministries turn them into enormous businesses, people like Dr. Dobson with hundreds of employees out there in Colorado, tens of millions of dollars of annual money changing hands, on hundreds and hundreds of radio stations with enormous power, so that, for instance, he worked very hard to get Richard Cizik at the National organization there of evangelicals thrown out when Cizik said that he was concerned about global warming because it didn't fit in with the Republican program. So, you know, this got so far away from anything to do with following Christ or religion or spirituality that it's just not possible to describe it to someone who hasn't lived through it. And, of course, that's what I try to do in the writing and in the book, but also have been doing with my HuffPost blogs, because I don't think people understand how radical the heart of this group is and how literally they would rather see America go down, let's say through the assassination of a president, to be blunt and brutal about it, than they would to have that president succeed. And of course, when you look at people like Rush Limbaugh, he's right on the edge of that already. He's saying he's as bad as bin Laden, doing bin Laden's work, and that he wants him to fail. Well, obviously, if you have a screw loose and you're just slightly more brave, let's put it this way, and consistent than Limbaugh is himself, you're sitting there in a well-armed little personal arsenal in your house with guns, you know, what's the next step? And with Tiller, we just saw a microcosm of where this stuff goes. And, of course, I'm afraid that we're going to see more of it because these people just keep ramping it up. There doesn't seem to be any natural limit to the vitriol.
Again, I'm speaking with Frank Schaefer, the author of Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. And your story is extraordinary. I'm just listening here. Frank, it's a pleasure to interview somebody. I can do the listening. Your story is extraordinary. Let me just go back, since you mentioned Tiller and the assassination of Dr. Tiller by this guy that owned eight guns, apparently. Now he's in jail, and he doesn't understand why he's in jail. He's saying they're treating me like a criminal. He clearly did not understand the fact that he murdered a human being right in a church.
Right.
He felt exempted, and this is what's so scary about the way the anti-abortion movement has been captured by the radical right, in the sense that they're offering a moral free ride. That you can go out and do anything in the name of God, including kill a human being. That's the same moral free ride that the Nazis offered up. You know,
they sanctioned.
You know, when you sanction that kind of exemption from the norms of morality in the name of something greater, that's literally the slippery slope of fascism.
Yeah, but you know, the interesting thing is, if you take a step back, you see the beginning of the extreme when you cross the line to lies. I mean, look, you know, yours is a progressive program. I have certain points of view. But it would be rare and certainly unwitting for you to tell a bold-faced lie, to have someone correct you, for you to know it was a lie, but because it fit your political bent, you'd keep telling it. Most people in the spectrum of what you might call decent political discourse may spin their view, but they don't outright lie. The religious right and the right wing in America, for instance, people in the McCain campaign, and by the way, McCain wrote a long, glowing endorsement of an earlier book of mine on the military-family relationship that came out called AWOL. This is a guy I've known, and in 2000, I actually worked for his campaign trying to get him elected instead of George Bush. That's how close I've been to this Republican machine. So, you know, I'm not some wild-eyed leftist from the outside. I'm speaking from the inside. Well, just take McCain and just take the insidious seduction that takes place. McCain is a smart guy. He knew perfectly well that Barack Obama is not a Muslim. He knew perfectly well that he's a mainstream American senator who's a moderate in his views. He likes him personally. He knew perfectly well that he didn't have some secret agenda to turn America into a communist country, that he wasn't working for terrorists, that he wasn't going to make America less safe, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, you know, he brought Sarah Palin on board, who's a far-right-wing, demagogic, Christian evangelical with all ties to weird groups such as this Free Alaska Party that wants to secede from the Union. He did it to throw a little bit of red meat to the right wing. He knew that at their rallies they had all these people yelling out all this awful stuff. Did nothing about it, because the fact is that once you get on this slope and you get into bed with these people who actually cultivate lies while knowing they are lies, certainly the smart people at the top do. They know they're lies. The fact that they don't answer those lies means they are culpable. And so, you know, when you have somebody like Dr. Tiller killed, it's the tip of the iceberg. But the real iceberg, as I see it, is that there is a tissue of lies that have been accepted as politics as usual by the right, which are totally untrue. And they know it. And they know it concerning the president. They know it concerning the left. They know it concerning the environmental movement. They know it concerning economic issues. They know it concerning a lot of these things. And yet they deal in this extreme hyperbole with no one in leadership positions calling them on it. In fact, it's gone the other way. You've got former Vice President Dick Cheney barefaced lying to the American people to try to salvage his reputation, going around saying America is now less safe because Barack Obama is in office, which is just so patently ludicrous on so many fronts. For instance, General Jim Jones, who is former Commandant of the Marine Corps, who I happen to know personally because he's read some of my books, Keeping Faith, A Father-Son Story About Love in the United States Marine Corps, that I wrote with my son who served in Afghanistan. You know, General Jones has written me a number of notes, and we've talked and we've met several times. He came out and just said, this is patently false. America is as safe as it was before, if not safer, because these policies that President Obama are pursuing are making America safer. And we just saw it again in Cairo. I mean, is America safer when a room full of 2,000 Arabic and Muslim students stand up and give your president a standing ovation, or when the whole world hates you? So what we now see is that the right-wing opposition to Obama has not just circled the wagons and become extreme. They're now dealing consciously in lies as an actual tactic. And of course, you're quite right talking about Joseph Goebbels. The whole policy of the big lie that the Nazis developed was exactly the same thing. And the American right is now slipping into that in an unprecedented way. And of course, my book talks about how this got going, in that thinking, you know, God is on your side, so there are no rules that apply to me. I'm doing the Lord's work here, whether it's gunning down an abortionist or telling lies about Barack Obama. The rules don't apply to me because we're on a mission from God. And that's all very funny in the Blues Brothers movie. It's not funny when the alternative American political party, being the Republicans, is being led by people who either are practicing these lies themselves or refusing to speak up against people within their party who are saying these things. And so, you know, you look at the way Rush Limbaugh goes unchallenged, for instance, by senators and congressmen when they get on TV shows because they're afraid of him. You look at the way Dick Cheney is getting away literally with lying barefaced to the American public, having been a vice president and a heartbeat away from the presidency. It's a scary time. It's a good time. It's a great time because we have a terrific new president and he's doing good things. It's a scary time because we have an unhinged minority in this country that is being egged on by people who know better, and they are not pulling in the rhetoric and the inciting that they're doing, because to them, in a sort of a desperate political position, they're going for broke. But at the end of that kind of going for broke is an assassin's bullet, and if they keep going this way, this is what they're going to stir up.
Frank, if you want to take your party back from the extent to which it's been hijacked by the religious right and by cynical operators within the Republican Party who saw this as an advantage, I don't mean to do a cheap shot here by bringing the Nazis back, but remember the German industrialists all thought that Hitler was a bit of a nutcase, but he was good for business because he was beating up on the unions and stuff. There was this kind of clearly a similar cynical calculus made by a lot of Republican power brokers. You know, we may Falwell and Robbins and maybe nutcases, but they bring the votes in. My question to you is twofold. One, how do you take your party back, the Republican Party? And two, as a Christian, how do you take the Bible back? Because the Bible has nothing to do with what these people stand for.
Right, exactly. And interestingly enough, speaking to the first, I've re-registered as an independent because I'm not a Republican and I doubt I ever will be again. But that wasn't because I left the Republican Party. It's because the Republican Party left me, as it were. When it comes to being a Christian, I am a Christian. I go to church, and I'm a believer, but I'm certainly not an evangelical right-wing Christian, as I point out in my book. And I think starting with the answer on Christian faith, you take the faith back simply by living it. You refuse to be embroiled in a political worldview, getting into your religious belief, and you understand that just as the separation of church and state applies within the country in terms of politics, it also has to apply in life, in that the ideal is not something you try to force other people into. And I'll take the issue of abortion. It's a sticky issue, tough one, and so let's just look at it head on. I do not like abortion. I think abortion is wrong. I would counsel people against having abortions. I would help people not to have an abortion, provide alternatives. All that said, I think Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. I think that people are sometimes in circumstances where abortion is something that is a regretful but necessary choice. I think that people get stuck in bad situations, and then if you don't want to have abortions, what you do is you provide compassionate alternatives of exactly the same kind that President Obama has been talking about. You don't resolve the ethical question through violence, and you don't resolve it through politics. You resolve it through presenting alternatives to people, and those alternatives have to be done in some way that gives us all a certain moral responsibility for carrying them out. And that starts with a lack of being judgmental. That starts with the lesson Christ teaches when the woman taken in adultery is brought before him. They want to stone this woman. He says, well, those of you without sin throw the first stone. Everybody melts away. He says, I don't condemn you either. That is the biblical lesson when it comes to not just abortion, but to any situation in which you're confronted with someone who has a problem and you are to treat them as you would want to be treated. So beginning with that, you have to understand that the moral issues that have become crusades with the religious right have been used primarily for fundraising and political power, not because they care about the issues themselves. If they did, they would be fighting tooth and nail to support President Obama's initiatives to help reduce the number of abortions by providing alternatives. They would be fighting tooth and nail to help gay people in both civil unions and or gay marriages achieve a level of dignity in our society that's been denied them. That doesn't mean that they would perform those weddings in their churches if their theological tradition was not in that direction, but they would not use the force of law and political agitation to stand against their fellow human beings' aspirations. And the fact of the matter is, when you politicize these moral issues, what you're doing is really trading your moral standing to be able to say, look, this is what I believe, here is the ideal that I would hold up, here is what I would help people to achieve, for shortcuts, which is politics. You know, we'll do it through the ballot box or the courts or whatever it may be. And, of course, that works both ways. I mean, that also applies to the left. I think sometimes the left wants to take shortcuts, too, and doesn't apply a really democratic principle to these things, but looks to end debate. So it isn't all one-sided here. But when it comes to reclaiming Christianity, I think you have to understand that faith and politics are two totally different things. And faith cannot be coercion, or it's not faith. So if you believe life begins at conception, or you believe that divorce is wrong or homosexuality is wrong, then faith dictates that that's how you live. And you hold out your life as an example of an alternative way of doing things to people that you believe is better. But the minute you try to make the law reflect that, then you're no longer talking about religion. You're talking about coercion. And that's about as far away from freedom of conscience, free will, and choosing the right thing, which is what religion is all about, as you can get. So it's not only different than religion. It is the opposite of religion. It is anti-religion. And so, you know, in that context, I think that that's how you reclaim it. When it comes to the politics, I think the Republican Party, sadly, is going to have to go through a tremendously self-destructive cycle in which eventually leaders come forward and disavow the base and say, we don't want this base. Better to build a new political party, whether it has the same name or a different name. But if you guys want to have your own fascist/Christian party, go off and do that. We don't want you. And until somebody like a McCain is willing to pay that price, it's not going to happen. And, you know, you had someone who came close to doing that with Colin Powell, for instance, who then got read out of the party by Dick Cheney and all the other right-wing commentators who said, well, he's not a real Republican. So right now, if you come along and say, I'm a Republican, but I believe that, for instance, Barack Obama is a good president and I'm thankful he went off to Egypt and gave that talk, then the answer is, well, you're not a real Republican. And of course, that again is really symptomatic of a party that's lost its way when it can't have a difference of opinion without reading people out of the party.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Frank Schaefer, and for your book, Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. I appreciate your coming on and educating us here today.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thanks a lot for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was speaking then with Frank Schaefer.
Thanks to Ian. Thanks to GN Master Control, Sean Heikemper, and everybody else who worked on the show today. I'm Alan Minsky, KPFK Senior Producer. Take it away.